Hello, everyone, and welcome to Primecast. I'm your host, Emmanuel Class, and joining me on this very special Mark IV episode is the captain of the ship, Matt Wilson.
Hey, Manuel. So, what do you think we should talk about today?
I'm not sure. I guess we could do some Riot Quest, maybe some Mon. No, definitely Mark IV. Absolutely Mark IV. Mark IV!
Mark
Let's do it.
IV, we announced it this week. So I guess my announcement was more like a novella. It's hard to think of anything to say that I didn't lay out in that article right now. I knew I had a lot to say when I sat down and started writing it, but then it just kind of took on a life of its own and went where it needed to go. I didn't want to leave anything unsaid. So we knew it was time for a new edition, inarguably overdue, actually. And the community knew it was time for a new edition. They've been asking for it for a long time. But this was it was a hard spot for us because there were problems that we needed to address with the new edition. And we knew that there was no way that we were going to make everybody happy with it. It's literally impossible. Sacrifices were going to have to be made, not just by us, but by players who have an investment and who have been around for a long time, or we just weren't going to be able to move forward with anything. I mean, we've been agonizing over this direction for years, with this new edition. It's just been something that we knew was inevitable. And we knew it was going to be rough. So this wasn't a time for, rah, rah, all new war hype. I didn't think that was the right tone for this sort of transition. And so I approached that article like, you and me, we're gonna sit down, we're gonna have a beer. We got a lot to tell you. Some of it is exciting and some of it's gonna sting. But what I hope is that by the end of our conversation is that you understand that the direction that we took was not taken lightly, that we're doing what we feel is the best thing that we can do for the future of War Machine, for the future of our community of players. If the game isn't growing, it's dying. And I don't think anyone is going to disagree that it was not growing, but the biggest reason for that is also the reason that we're making these changes and that these changes, some of them are a little painful.
Sometimes you have to have a little pain point to grow. There's thorns in the nest, so to speak, to make you fly. And all of these changes were not only necessary, but an evolution of the game industry itself and the company and where it's going. I know that when I first came on board, one of the reasons I was brought on was the expansion of playtesting to get ready for this. And we were years out, and it was, very heavily discussed, and nothing was taken lightly, and every stone was turned over and discussed. So I think this is the best version, the most, clear path ahead. And I'm really excited to see that roadmap.
Yeah, me too. I think like you said, we really have been talking about it for years, right? It's been something that has occupied our attention front and center for a couple of years. We've gone through multiple scenarios, different directions that we were going down and turned back because, we get to a certain point, we think this isn't the way we want it to go, right? Or, we didn't want to abandon the things that people love about War Machine, or the community. But, at the end of the day, like I said in the article, the biggest issue is that we just have this massive catalog, and even though we love everything in the catalog, it's too big. It's too big for distributors to stock. It's too big for retailers to stock. And what that does is it limits availability for everybody, right? When they can't easily access the products. And that's a problem unto itself, but it's also just too big for new players to get into.
And something's got to give.
Definitely. I would love it if we didn't have to worry about the business side of things, right? I love War Machine. I love making games and building worlds, telling stories. And I would love to be in a place where we could do all of those things without worrying about how to pay the monthly lease on our building or how materials and, how much
Yeah,
materials and
absolutely.
equipment cost or making sure that our staff can afford to pay their rent. But the reality is, we can't continue to keep developing a game that people play with things they bought years ago because that doesn't support the company that has ongoing and constant expenses. So while we have always wanted to try and protect that investment that people make in their armies and, all the hobby time they put into them, it was naive of us to think that we could do that forever while still continuing to expand the catalog of models. I mean, name one other product that you can buy once, but you expect that the manufacturer is going to continually upgrade it in perpetuity. I love the idea of it, but coming face to face with the reality of it is, it's agonizing. And we saw it through the Mark III era, where our idea was to flesh out themes, you know, within the factions. But what this meant was that players ended up sort of cherry picking, you know, what they wanted to add to their collections. And, you know, and we were spreading that over 14 or 15 factions. And it did become sort of unsustainable, you know, this point of diminishing returns where we're making new stuff, but, you know, it's not necessarily something that everybody has to have, you know, for a given faction or whatnot. But we learned from it, you know, and we took stock of everything that we've been through over the past 6 years since the third edition came along, and we identified the issues. And I mean, look, the easiest thing to do would have been just to start over, right? We could rip Band-Aid off. Let's move on, do something else. If you're someone who wants to play the new edition and you want to do it with models that you bought years ago, it's not really supporting the new edition. If we make validating everything that has come before the new edition the priority, we can't survive as a company and continue to develop the game. It's a paradoxical idea. But at the same time, we don't want to abandon anyone in our community, you know, whether they're a new player or playing with an army that they collected in the Mark I era, right? Like you know, we've done our best to split the difference. We have to make room for new development and new players because, like we said at the beginning, the game has to grow or else. But we're doing our best to create an avenue for those who have been part of the community, you know, for a long time, but just don't want to plunge into a new army. We want to give them a way to still participate and be part of the next generation of the game. You know, from a pure business point of view, it's not necessarily the best thing for us to do, but we believe there is value in maintaining the strength of the community, even if not everyone in it is actually directly supporting the game.
Absolutely. Sometimes in business, things are intangible and you can't put a dollar amount on what it means to just have people, and people are the most valuable thing to any business. And so we have such a rich and vibrant community. We don't want to alienate anybody, and we want everybody to be as excited about the new edition as we are.
Absolutely. You know, at the end of the day, what matters most when you get into a game is that, you know, there's going to be someone that you can play with, right? So in the greater scheme, our belief is that it's better for the long-term growth and health of War Machine to make sure people can keep playing, whether they are new players or, you know, buying armies or haven't bought a thing in years. Without a community of players, we've got no one to play the game with. So we want everyone to know that we appreciate that they have made an investment in the armies, and we want them to have a place in every edition that we make. But as editions change, so will that role. You know, if we don't make room for a continued development and growth, then we'll end up stuck in place, and then we don't have a game at all anymore.
Yeah, so what's going to happen to the back catalog? There are thousands of models that we have molds for.
Thousands. And imagine every one of those models, most of those models are multiple pieces. So you take thousands of models and then you multiply them by, you know, anywhere from 2 to 5 or 10. I mean, we've got thousands and thousands of molds. Reality is ultimately it will all go out of print. And there's a few reasons for this. First, our expectation is that with this announcement of new armies, demand on the back catalog is probably not going to be particularly high. It's plagued us for the last few years. You know, if we get an order for an item that we don't have in stock, it might take someone several hours just to spin all the molds required to make that one model. But that's not a good business model where a caster spends half of the shift to make a model that's going to, you know, make $6. So we need to let those things that are not in high demand go out of print, because otherwise what happens is on the rare occasion someone convinces a retailer to order one of those things, it gets included with a big distributor order of other things that we have in stock or that are being ordered in high numbers. And we end up doing what we call a short ship because we're trying to service as much of that order as possible. But if we have to spot fill those sort of low demand items, it's going to hold everything up. So it's also the same reason that a lot of our plastic SKUs have gone out of print. In order for us to get them back in stock, we have to order several thousand units of them, but we know we're only going to move, you know, maybe a few hundred, maybe less. And so it just doesn't make sense. And then of course, on top of all this, we've got the metal issue. Prices on metal have risen beyond it being a viable material to make toy soldiers with. And while we have some in stock, when it's gone, it's going to be gone forever. And that means anything that we've ever made in metal is going to go out of print.
But now that we're going to be producing using 3D printing, can't we just keep making that stuff that there is demand for?
Well, it depends on how old it is. Half of the stuff in our back catalog was sculpted traditionally before 3D sculpting came along. Those things can't just be converted into 3D printing. We would have to resculpt them all over again. As well, the things that we made that were produced as plastic kits use a completely different process. So you can't just turn around and throw those onto the 3D printers. But some of the stuff, particularly if it was made in the last few years, will be a lot easier to convert to 3D printing if we feel like there's a reason to do it or a demand.
So when the metal runs out, we're not making metal anymore. And there are a lot of back catalog that will go out of print. What about stuff like Monsterpocalypse and Warcaster and Riot Quest that are still pretty recent and use metal parts?
Well, almost everything that has been done since the relaunch of Monsterpocalypse has been 3D sculpted. Not every single thing, but most of it. And none of it was made for overseas plastic production. So it'll be fairly easy for us to convert those catalogs to 3D printing over time. Right now, I can't say how long that's going to be, but eventually we will move most of our production, if not all of it, into 3D printing.
I know you talk about it in the announcement a lot, but why 3D printing? Why not plastics or something else?
Well, I've touched on it a little bit in the past, but basically, plastic isn't real good for a company our size if we want to be able to continue offering something over a long period of time. Our biggest supply issues right now are with the plastics that we haven't been able to restock. Like I said earlier, the minimum order quantities on plastics are significant. So if you're not turning over a lot of volume all the time, eventually you're going to reach a point of diminishing returns where restocking a plastic item is going to come at a loss. All of our plastic kits that are out of stock right now would have cost us vastly more to replenish than what we could have sold of them. So between that and all the other frustrations of dealing with overseas manufacturing, it means that plastic just isn't a good model for us. 3D printing, though, is something that we can continue to do in-house. We've got total control over the quality of the product. We can continue to innovate and we can improve our systems and processes as the technology continues to improve, which we all know it will. So there's this immense flexibility in 3D printing, and nothing ever needs to go out of stock. And even those spot fill issues that I mentioned earlier are no longer a problem because printing something obscure doesn't require any more effort than, printing something that is ordered every day. And that means orders aren't going to be held up by sort of oddball items that don't get ordered very often. More than anything, or I should say, what's most exciting to me about the 3D printing is that it doesn't work like our traditional two-port mold manufacturing at all. We can make these incredible, complex models that would otherwise be made up of many, many pieces, but we can do so in just a few pieces that are easy to put together. 3D printing is what has made customization of the Warjacks possible. The cavities those magnets go in can't be replicated in a two-part mold casting process without dividing the torsos of the models up into many more pieces. So now we're making model parts that are impossible to make any other way than 3D printing, and they look amazing. Like when you see the shield arm on that Stryker Warjack and you see that it's all one piece, but there's a gap between the arm and the shield it's holding, like that's amazing. And that can't be done with any other manufacturing process without making it into multiple parts.
Oh my God, yes. I put together the Mark IV boxes for the Orgoth and the Storm Legion, and I was just so impressed. Like, the quality was amazing, and like, if there was any flesh, any stepping, you could just like rub it off with your thumb. They were so clean. They went together so well. All of the spots where the magnets went in and came together was so crisp. I was just blown away. So, 3D printing, is it cheaper? Is it more expensive? Obviously, it's not as expensive as metal. Do we just push a button and magic happens?
I wish. 3D printing has changed our production pipeline in that we don't have to make molds of the miniatures anymore, but we've traded that expense for engineering of the miniatures, which can be a lengthy process of testing and revising the 3D files and then printing again, until we find the perfect file that we will use for the actual production. So it's important to remember as well that the material cost of a model is not all that goes into it. Before we ever produce a model, there's concept artwork, we've got rules development, the sculpt, the paint job. All of that is part of the expense of creating a model and has to get justified. And then that model has to keep us in business. So, but on the production side, it's not just a push button process either, as some people would think, because it's just a printer. Every print job is set up by hand. Every printer has to be maintained and cleaned, and there's regular maintenance. Sometimes prints fail, and it can be a chore to clean up the mess. Anybody who's, has any experience with 3D printing knows what that's like. And then once printers come off the printers, we have to remove the support structures, and we have to clean them and cure them. And then ultimately, everything has to be packed. So all of that is done by hand. 3D printing is not an automatic process. The printers replace our casting machines in the process of making the models, But every model still requires a very hands-on process to get it to the customer.
So what does that mean for our pricing?
For the most part, I'd say it's pretty close to a wash, you know. But one advantage 3D printing does give us is stability. With metal, we were always concerned with the mass of a model because every fraction of an ounce was being counted. With 3D printing, the swing on mass isn't necessarily as great. So it's enabling us to create more consistent pricing while also, you know, keeping it conservative. So like, let's take these battle groups that we're previewing at Gen Con, for instance. We're doing the Warcaster and two Warjacks for $75. And sure, in the past, our starters were 50, but first of all, that was 6 years ago and things cost more now. But more importantly, you have to look at how much you're getting. Each of the Warjacks has eight arms and four heads, probably doubling or more the total mass of the material of one complete model. So we couldn't offer that in metal or hand-poured resin at all, right? This is made possible through the 3D printing. We haven't had a chance to show the contents of what we'll be releasing with the core army boxes, but those are going to be great values as well. We're looking at, you know, we're estimating $199 for 22 models. And that includes two Warjacks with all the weapon and head options. You know, a la carte, those Warjacks are going to be priced at $35 for a light, 45 for a heavy. But remember, they have an arsenal of options included with them greater than the mass of the complete model itself. So if you consider the Warjacks as $80 worth of the core starter, then you're dividing the remaining $120 by 20 models, which means the average price of a model is about $6, you know, which for the most part is better than what we've ever been able to do in the past. And that's not just a bunch of like, you know, repeated troopers. That includes your Warcaster and your standard bearers and your larger medium-based infantry, all of which would have traditionally commanded much higher prices on their own.
With 3D printing, if we print it overseas, would that reduce the overall cost for people who have to purchase overseas and find that the fees of getting it shipped over there can price them out?
It eliminates some of the cost. It can eliminate, I mean, it eliminates shipping costs, which is a big thing that marks things up when they go overseas. And it can eliminate import taxes. But depending on where you live, you're still going to have things like VAT. And so it won't get rid of that. But we do believe that by localizing production overseas, it can help access and it can help reduce some of the costs associated with purchasing overseas.
That seems right in line with the market standards and what we're doing, and it does seem like it's better for everybody.
Yeah, I think if price comparisons are how you decide which miniatures game you want to go into, then you're gonna find that what we're doing with Mark IV isn't just competitive, but it also makes sense. Personally, I don't know if most people make their entertainment budget spending decisions based on the gram weight of what they're buying. You buy potato chips or dog food that way, but when it comes to entertainment value, that doesn't make as much sense. You know, I don't choose my movie rentals, for instance, by the length of the movie. I buy what I think is going to be good.
Absolutely. Well, that brings us to the next phase of War Machine, which is all new and upcoming app. What do I need to buy to get into that?
We're creating the next edition of War Machine to live exclusively in the War Machine app. And it's being designed to enhance the game experience as much as possible. Previously, War Room was trying to replicate a physical printed card experience in the app. And it was done well and it worked great. But with Mark IV, we're embracing what the digital medium can do to enhance the gaming experience. So we're no longer constrained by the concept of a physical card and what can appear on the front or back. We're looking forward to being able to access information at the tap of a button. This is sort of a crazy example, but during our development process, it was put forth that Warjack power attacks aren't often used in games because players can't remember how the complex rules work and they don't want to take the time to crack open the book, which is totally understandable. So we set out to solve issues like that with the app. In Mark IV, Warjacks are specifically designated which power attacks they can use, and then you'll be able to just tap the icon on their card to reference that rule. So the whole idea behind the new War Machine app is that we're going to remove those friction points that slow the game down and make the game easier to access.
So what is that going to cost? Do I buy a deck of cards?
No, sir. No. We are planning to release the beta version of the War Machine app in October, and the app's where the game lives. And as an app, it's entirely free. All the model stats and game rules are free download. You'll even be able to print cards from the app if you want, and you can store your tournament builds locally on the device. All of that is free.
You're speaking my language. Free 99. Free all day. Let's go. This is great. So free.
Yeah, it's free. Everything you need to play the game is free in the app. And that's how you play the game. And we just want no barriers to it.
But there is a subscription available.
Yes. After the app gets through its beta stage, we will offer a subscription for premium content. Think of it like what we used to do with No Quarter Magazine. Fiction, new scenarios, strategy articles, organized play content. We're dreaming all this stuff up right now. It's all the kinds of stuff that we can deliver through the app. And the subscription will be $4.99 a month. You'll still be able to play the game without the subscription. But if you're the type of player that wants to immerse yourself in the world and participate in global events and, you know, go deep, we're building that functionality into the app for you.
Okay. I love my 3D printed models. Been getting them ready for Gen Con this week, and I can't wait for the Mark IV app. It sounds amazing. So now tell me, when is Legion going to get something?
So this is a big point of confusion that we've seen since we posted the announcement. The way that we have reclassified factions and armies has proven to be just a little bit confusing. Before Mark IV, everyone sort of chose a faction, right? And if they supported that faction, then any new model that came out for that faction was technically supporting the faction, whether it worked for your army or not. But that's a problem, right? If you play Trenchers and we release a Storm Knight model, then we're technically supporting Signar, but in reality, not necessarily your army. So we have refocused Mark IV, and as a player going forward, you won't identify on a faction level. You will choose an army. Maybe that army is part of your favorite faction because you like their culture or ethos, but faction, in quotes, right, doesn't determine what your force building options are. That's the army, right? Basically, we kind of all have to stop saying faction, and it's hard. We're battling to get it right internally every day. We're correcting ourselves to make sure that we're saying everything accurately. And we're trying to change 20 years of habits here. But the dividing line is really where Mark IV starts. Nothing that we're going to be making in the future can be used in a force with legacy models, even if they're from the same faction.
So I have a Legion army. Do I get to play in Mark IV?
Well, ultimately, all of it will have rules in the Unlimited Arena, but some of it will be playable in the Prime Arena. And we'll be focusing on Prime armies first so that existing players can get right into the game. However, we're anticipating at least 14 to 16 months to convert all of the existing model rules to Mark IV standards, because as we noted, we have thousands of models. But we are hoping to recruit help to make that happen sooner than later. So, you know, maybe we'll even do it faster than we think we can.
Great. So where do we go from here?
Well, sir, you and I are going to Gen Con next week.
Gen Con!
And that's going to be great because, I mean, this is our first time back in 3 years. So, and we're going to have the preview battle groups there, and anyone at Gen Con is going to get to see those new models for the first time. And I am super excited about that.
I couldn't be more hype. This will actually be my first Gen Con. So what a way to attend. And I'm really excited to see everybody, get to hang out, and I will also have my battle groups with me. So if you want to get a demo in, hang out, play some Monpok, talk Mark IV, come see me at the booth.
I will see you there.
You want to say it, Captain?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Roll the drums.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. In this segment, I am joined by Jason Soles and Eric Ryerson. They're going to talk with me about Mark IV and clear up some confusion, answer some questions, and really dig into the meat and potatoes of what Mark IV is going to be. So welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you. How's it going?
Thanks. Good to be here.
I'm glad to have you both back. We always have some really fun stuff to talk about, and this is on the heels of the big announcement. We have let the cat out of the bag, done a whole lot to show everybody what is coming up. And so now we're going to talk a little bit more about that announcement. Eric, do you want to lead us in and show us what we're going to talk about first?
Well, just to address a lot of independent concerns that have come up as a result of the announcement and try and give corrective mindset on how we approach things and how they'll actually function in the game. Units, as we have addressed previously, we wanted to trim down for several described reasons. And with the size decrease came a decreased ability for them to actually apply attacks and have table presence. The new movement system, they regained this in spades and gave a lot of new paradigms to how units move and interact on the tabletop. Mm. And with that, there's also other factors that balance with them, like attrition to a unit is far more hindering, like a greater percentage is lost of the unit and the unit point cost with each model lost. And the new way AoEs are applied, since every time a unit moves, they're placed within 2 inches, a 2-inch AoE with the new system that now affects two additional models within 2 inches, they're actually quite vulnerable. And AoEs have like a much greater value of controlling units as your primary purpose. So with this in mind, they're very maneuverable. Despite being small, they're able to apply their damage very well without any boosts or anything. But they also have their relative balance in relation to other new mechanics that exist in the game.
We wanted to make the new units a very different model type and make sure they had a place in the game despite the changes that they had gone through. And so the new movement's kind of an extrapolation of how groups can slip through and how they can come out unexpected vectors. So while the new unit system offers some real different tabletop tactics and applications, it's all sort of what we were looking for out of them as we continue to explore what a unit could be in the game.
I think these changes were really interesting. With shrinking unit sizes, it does have a rippling effect on so many other things, like Eric had mentioned with AoEs, and like Jason had mentioned with the placement and the places that you can get to with units and being able to fill a role other than just being bodies on the table or something to push into a zone. And I think that's really interesting. It will make the game smoother. It will definitely speed up table time. It does speed up table time. I know we can all speak from experience on that. So I think they're really interesting changes, and I think it's moving in the right direction and excited to see those changes.
Other things we looked at is the removal of arcs. Mm-hmm. Arcs on the bases, other than the difficulty of marking them, since we don't already do it in-house, is it ends up being sort of a new player trap where the exact facing of models isn't really thought of in the process of movement by a brand new player. They don't see where they need to be cutting off and where they need to be turned to account for on the following turn. And due to the dynamic poses of models and the three-dimensionality of some terrain, it's hard to get the model balanced while facing the direction you want or close enough to the enemy model without contact. Removing the facing removes a lot of all the finickiness of that. Its exact location and precise location on the board will still have great tactical applicability, but it doesn't have to be oriented also in this exact way. With that, there were a lot of abilities that are affected in the game, such as backstab. I know a lot of people were worried about their models that took advantage of facing. Any model that keys off of any rule that we've changed or a mechanic that's been altered significantly, we will be evolving to a Mark IV version of it that still keeps a distinct role for it and flavor, even if it won't do that specific thing it used to do.
Removing facing also, it greatly decreases the cognitive load of every single time you touch a model and move it at all. It just speeds everything right along. And I think it's been one of those changes that we've been waiting in the wings to introduce for a long time now. I think it just streamlines and cleans up play and basically, well, every interaction where you touch a model.
I think it's great, especially somebody who's played competitively quite a bit and played under chess clock. When you start to play under pressure, things get a little sloppy, and sometimes having a game lost or determined because a model wasn't precisely angled the right way to cut off the free strike, even though the model's position is correct and the intent is there, the model not being exactly there means that you either didn't have the time to take or you needed to take extra time. And so this eliminates all of that pressure. You can just play, put your models down, and keep going. And I'm a big fan of it. I have used it quite a bit. I think it's great. I think it moves things along much faster.
Awesome.
I know a lot of players are really interested to hear what armies are making it into Prime specifically. And unfortunately, I don't have all those answers right now. as we're still in the middle of development. And even if one specific army seems like a shoo-in, it might be divided up slightly differently. And I don't want to give people false hope of what makes it across the border. But some things I can sort of say to a certainty is that the limited factions such as Grimkin, Crucible Guard, Infernals, they'll be coming over in entirety. They won't have anything left behind. And there are certain themes that are really iconic and really inspiring that have made it so far that will just definitely make across. Like, you will see a trencher force for Signar. You will see Mana War for Kador.
We already have playtest versions of those.
And with mercenaries, we realized two would be too restrictive, and there's a lot of interesting flavors and army types that could get left behind. So in their case, Cephalix, Rule, Pirates, and Steelheads will all have playable armies with all of their key models involved in Prime. And minions, of course, Gators and Pharaoh make it. As far as the other ones, there's ones that may be more obvious than others that at least will come forward in some respect, but I don't want to speak on it preemptively and, you know, give people false aspirations. However, when something does come across, like Mana War, all the support Mana War solos, everything that gives that army flavor will come with it. It's not like Dragos will get left behind or anything. Like, he'll be there, Forge Seer, Atanas Arkanovich, anything that's really Mana War themed and related will make the cut. So if you have an army that's heavily themed, anything that follows that theme, you should be feel pretty safe will make a crossover.
Interesting. That's really good. I think that gives some signaling to what people can expect. They can look at their armies. It's easy to draw some themes out of those armies and go, yeah, most of my models are probably coming to some degree. You know, I think that a lot of us are already set up for that from Mark III for playing in themes and having a lot of these models collectively already together. It makes a lot of sense that they will cross over together as well.
Yeah.
I've seen some concerns about the cognitive load of all the options on these new jacks. And although I agree that it is a lot up front, you get one jack and you have to know 8 arms and 4 heads, but there will be only one of each size per army. So in the Orgoth Sea Raiders army, there's just the one Tyrant chassis. And if you look at an army like Signar, they have 14 different heavies that all have different mats, speeds, armor values, rats. And even in Signar alone, there's 5 hammers that all have different ranges, different powers, and do different things. Whereas with the new jacks, the flail's the flail, the hammer's the hammer. Like, the right arm options are limited. There's like generally 2 melee weapons, 2 range weapons, or 3-in-1. And there'll generally be, if that's the AoE gun, that's the straight shot gun, or that's the reach weapon, that's the short range weapon. And a lot of it will come much more intuitive once you actually start seeing the models on the table. Also, although there's a lot of available combinations, there's really somewhere to 8 where you'll actually see that combination, any sort of routine. And the heads, since they're just singular abilities, a lot of times you know it's going to be one of the 2 melee abilities on the melee jack. You just have to check with your opponent, memorize the head, whichever. I mean, it's an open communication game. It shouldn't be too difficult. But this should remove a lot of the burden of memorization of what we saw with previous armies and their jacks. Like Kador, I believe, has 4 different axes. Similarly, all different ranges, powers, different special abilities. And now it's just very trimmed down. And I think there's a lot less to remember, even if it's a lot up front at the initial launch.
It also sounds like a whole lot of what you're saying comes out of some personal experience.
Mayhaps.
Personal experience is a good place to land on too, because repetition is what's going to help you learn any game, right? If you look at any game and say, I can't memorize it all before playing it, you're right. You probably can't. Like, how many times have you sat down and had to reread the rules of Monopoly? But it's that the repetition of seeing them on the table, you will see the same chassis repeated. You'll see a lot of the same loadouts and weapons repeated. And so it'll get to a point where there's so much less to memorize that you won't have to worry about which variation of a chassis or, you know, weapon that you're seeing. And being able to positively identify at a glance is something that competitive gamers get really good at, because, you know, you play against a lot of the same things over and over again. It's a skill to build up. And I think this makes that skill that much easier.
I know there's a lot of concerns about people's old casters being able to keep up with the new ones. but I can give some assurance that we're definitely bringing those guys up into the new field. We're looking at new abilities, we're looking at spell lists, and we're reevaluating. And we're definitely going to focus on maintaining parity as best as possible. The prime casters, especially, the idea is to keep each army relatively in line and competitive with each other. And through that, we're going to make sure that they all come forward as strong as possible. Now, it does not mean we're going to ignore the unlimited casters that don't make the jump. We still want all these characters that we created and models to be strong and something inspiring for people to put on the tabletop. And in fact, they probably have an advantage against Mark IV armies in the unlimited format, whereas instead of having the tight, defined armies, you'll have a lot more options at your disposal than the new armies. And you may find when playing against your friends, because I imagine people play unlimited for a while till things really get going, that you will not feel at a disadvantage compared to the new items.
We're also looking at adding new capabilities to those models that they didn't have previously. And in some cases, they're going to be entirely new models if they focus on aspects of the game that we've evolved past Mark IV. So there's going to be a lot of old things new again as we proceed.
That's really exciting. So that does mean that in its own way, Legacy Armies will be getting some new releases because they'll be new to the Mark IV edition.
Yeah. You could look at it that way.
Awesome. Well, Eric, Jason, is there anything else that we didn't cover? Any other questions or gray areas out there that you wanted to address?
I am sure that we have missed a lot of things that the community wants stronger answers on. And there's a lot to parse through right now. I'm sure even the community is seeing that themselves. And in time, we will try and answer all those questions as best we can, or some will be answered through the process of insiders, rules updates, or seeing the product for yourselves. But we will try and be responsive. We'll try not to ignore any concerns people have and just be vocal. If you don't put the question out there, it's not going to get answered. And I'd be happy to help out with anything else you guys want to know.
Outstanding. Eric, Jason, thank you both for being on Primecast with me today. Always a pleasure.
Hell yeah.
When you guys want to say roll drums?
Till next time.
See you later.
And roll drums. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. On this next segment, I have a very special CF3, Charles Foster III, back with me, and he's going to be talking about some of the models, painting, putting them together, and his experience with them. How you doing, Charles?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. Thanks for having me back on.
It's an absolute pleasure. I know it's so much exciting stuff to dive into. We should have probably recorded the whole before banter because we were talking about Mark IV and building models, and we were just like, oh my gosh, we should just get to recording because the excitement is real.
Yeah, no, I am unbelievably excited about Mark IV. I like the fact that everybody's kind of like, okay, it's a new edition. Everybody's a beginner again. So, and then with the sweet models and the story progressing, like, this is going to be a good time to get in the game.
Ooh, you bring up such a good point. Everybody kind of coming back down to like the same level again, starting small, you know, reseeding armies. I'm really excited about that as well. So, and speaking of, like, they are fantastic. The materials, the magnets, the models, it's so great.
Yeah. The new models are absolutely fantastic. And a lot of you out there have probably seen by now, I think my insider's up, where I did the Orgoth models. It's not just the Orgoth models. All the new models coming, the Signar Storm Legion, the Kador Winter Core, Dusk of House Killis.
Yeah.
Pronunciation pending. I'm not sure I'm saying that right. I haven't asked Matt.
You're not a full elf, is that what you're telling me?
Not yet.
Give it time.
I mean, I'm going full Eldritch. Let's get there.
Without a doubt.
I can't wait to see them. I know Doug Hamilton's out there right now working on the last few Dusk models, and I mean, I have yet to not paint a Doug model and been super over the top excited about it. So I'm clearly going to end up having to pick those up at some point.
Oh yeah. I'm really excited. Doug's always going to knock something like that out of the park too. It is right up his alley. He loves the kind of dark and ethereal, and so I'm super excited to see how he pulls it off and how you paint them, because just like your Riot Quest models, you can take some really fantastic spins on paint jobs.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I of course did a little bit of a semi-studio scheme on the Orgoth models of my Insider, because I am not a non-metallic metal god like Eric Swinson. He completely knocked it out of the park on the studio paint models for Orgoth, but I will be doing, obviously, an alternate scheme eventually for my Orgoth. It will just depend on when I get a chance to actually get my copy of the models and start painting.
Awesome. So you've been pretty pleased with the quality of the models, it seems.
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding me? I mean, you got your hands on one of the battle groups. These things are insane. I literally cleaned the model in, like, maybe 4 or 5 minutes. You get out some clippers, a little snip here, a little snip there. And, I mean, that's just it. I had to literally keep reminding myself while I was looking over the model that there's no mold lines anymore. They don't exist in the printed model world. So, like, no, you spend
Stop
that extra
looking
time.
For them.
Yeah, because normally you're kind of, like, flipping a model over, looking underneath it, trying to find it. You're like, where is it? Where, like, you can't stop looking. You're like, it's got to be there. I know it has to be there. It's a model.
Yeah.
And it's not.
There's so little flash. There's so little prep. I actually find it really satisfying. The few tiny little steps I do find, I'm like, oh yeah, here we go. And then you brush them off and you're like, well, I guess that's it.
I mean, you literally just are like, if you have clippers, you just literally clip these little nubs off that are perfectly sitting off the model, or take a hobby knife and just, they're gone. And it's like 4 or 5 minutes. And like, I was trying to talk to like my wife, who's a little bit into some of the hobby stuff. She was watching me and she's like, you're giggling to yourself while you're assembling something. Is everything okay? Have you lost it? Did you finally go over the deep end with the models? I was like, well, and I pulled out Resnik 1 and I compared it to Horusk as I was assembling it. And I was like, this Resnik 1, you know, it took like 20 to 25 minutes to like clean, prep it, properly assemble it. You're looking at it and you're like, okay, well, the hand with the scroll probably needs to be pinned. There's a rack on the back. So you pull out a pin vise, you drill into it, you pin it, you glue it. It's been like 30 minutes by the time you get it all cleaned up properly and assembled. And Horusk, I was like, all right, well, clip here, clip here, clip. Just put some glue, I guess, and I'm done. Okay.
Right.
So like, I don't know about you, but me personally, when I sit down, I've always been in that mindset. I'm like, all right, today's going to be an assembly day, or today's going to be a painting day, because assembling is just so taxing usually. You're like, all right, I'm going to do a 10-man unit of plastic models, and you just pull out, you know, your hobby knife, your glue, and you turn on like an extended version of Lord of the Rings or something, and you just, you're chilling for the next 3 to 4 hours working on 10 guys, because that's what it would take before. And with these new models, it's literally like clip, glue up. Oh, that was it. Oh my gosh, that was it. So it's just, it's an insanely different world now.
Absolutely. I remember when I was assembling the Storm Legion stuff, I remember saying to myself, where was this technology when I was a kid? Like, I've been building models since, like, as long as I can hold clippers and put models together, since, you know, the old days of all pewter. And watching it evolve to that point where I imagine this being somebody's first kit, right? Their first model kit. They're going to pick it up. It's going to be so easy to assemble. There's going to be like so little friction for them to actually build this, paint it, and get it on the table. I feel like the bar for entry just drops. Just instantly drops.
Absolutely. If you go back to like the way early days of Mark II, so I had multiple factions that I was into.
Oh, yeah.
And I, of course, had a Sylena and Nis Hunters for each one of those factions. I think I've assembled 4 or 5 Sylenas over, and the units over the time of playing the game. I think I even assembled one for a buddy, which I don't know how he convinced me to help him do that, but I did it. Because that's in all honesty, I think that's probably the most difficult kit to assemble out of like the old metal models from back in the day. Mm-hmm. There's individual arms. You had to position a sword. They had a backpack, a crossbow, a longbow, a quiver of arrows for each model. And it's just like, oh my gosh, each one of these things and separate heads. So you're talking about, two arms, a body, a head, and three attachments. So you're up in like the 7 or 8 piece range for most of these models. And I mean, they were really hard to assemble for a very average hobbyist. It was such a barrier for entry for the game. They're like, I just glued my fingers together. I don't know what I'm doing. But compared to the new kits, you're like, okay, well, I'm just going to attach this one head, this, or the, not even this head, the head's part of the body. It's like one arm, the backpack, done. Or I have preset magnet holes. I don't even have to spend time drilling in to set them. Like, there's no real hobby time involved in it. You can just get the models and get them onto the table so quickly.
I was a little spoiled building so many Monpok models lately. There's just been a whole flood of them, and I have had them on my painting table, and I've been building them, and they're so simple, right? They're like just a couple pieces, put them together. Some of the unit boxes, you literally dump on the table. You're like, oh, they're all one piece. I'm done. And so coming back to War Machine, I was like, oh my gosh, what are these kits? In my head, I'm going through all the prep work I used to have to do, all of the washing, all the insane amount of like detail clipping and re-green stuffing and everything. And thinking of the time crunch even that, between now and Gen Con to get it all done. And I poured out the pieces and I looked at how clean it was and how easy it was going to be to assemble. And I just smiled. I couldn't be more happy. So they turned out fantastic.
Yeah, no, I'm just blown away by it. I mean, the other thing too is like, I know most people out there, because we said they were a printed resin. Mm-hmm. Like, people have been saying like, oh, well, where are the build lines? Like, show me the layering. Show me the various separation layers. There's no way you're getting good quality. And I'm like, we're not going to go give away the secrets of how we're doing everything, but like, there aren't any. We've been working on this for quite some time. Our production guys have been knocking it out of the park, stress testing things, finding new ways and improvements of the process, and like really putting it through the ringer before we were like, all right, well, people are going to look at this and go, what is this new material? It's very different from others that you've used before. So we're like, yeah, well, okay, we'll admit it. We're printing. We've eliminated molds. So hopefully everybody will be really excited. I am insanely excited about getting my hands on like the actual army boxes and checking those out now.
Me too. So what about the Warjack kits? Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, like, same thing, right? They're super clean, super easy. Normally, back in the early days of Mark II, those, plastic kits, I myself would magnetize them just because that was something that I always wanted to have. So like the Rover, you'd get a Renegade Rover and a Mule, and you're mm-hmm. like, oh, I need to magnetize these so that I can swap these out. And I don't think I ever put a Mule on the table like one time in Mark II or Mark III. but I had to magnetize those kits so that I had that ability, the modular ability to swap those out in my list building. So when we were like, all right, we're sitting down from like Mark IV, what if we made them all modular and like we'll fold that into the game? Well, how are we going to do that? And so we started exploring the process of like getting the models to where people can swap arms and legs. Do we want to do like friction sockets and some other stuff? Like, we tried a bunch of different things. We're like, magnets, just use magnets. They're there. We're switching to 3D printing. We can preset the holes. We can just put magnets in the box and everybody will have the ability to just modular their things. And it was just an instant, duh, we figured it out. We know what we're doing. So the first time, we stuck magnets in the kits and we're like looking at them in the office, it was just this moment where we're like, oh my gosh, this is going to be so good. And I mean, I'm completely impressed by how like strong the magnet connections even are in the jacks. Like,
oh yeah,
I clearly did not like use the right style of magnets back in the day, because like the sockets for like some of the older jacks weren't very big. So you're using like an 1/8 inch magnet mm-hmm. to try and hold on this massive arm. So the arms would fall off. So for this kit, when we went in, we're really going to make sure that we use the right size. So like the magnets that go into the kit are much bigger, right? They're 3/16 for some of the heavies. And then like some of the smaller pieces, they do use an 1/8, but I mean, they're real small. So it's like the light war jack with the heads use an 1/8 inch, and then the big arm sockets use 3/16. So they're huge. So
the snap on them is so satisfying.
Yeah, I mean, it is a real solid hold. You don't have to worry about the arm going limp and falling off, or the arm spinning around while you're trying to move the model around on the table.
They hold a pose.
Yeah, yeah. You have to make the effort to, like, pull the arm off. instead of just like it falling off.
So, tell me, what was the hardest part of the Orgoth Insider that you did? Because you've put a lot of work into those models, even though it was easy to prep, there's still a lot to be done.
Yeah, no. So, like, the hardest part was actually, like, trying to come up with a good system to, like, paint all the arms for sure. But I think even harder than that was knowing that I was working on this massive insider, getting ready to show off all this cool stuff, massive amount of time painting it up. And then I knew that I was going to have to use these are the con demo models, right? Mm-hmm. These are going out to convention season. I didn't get to keep them. So I knew that I was putting like 40, 50 hours into like painting up all these sweet looking things. And then getting ready to just hand them off. So same with the Signar battle group. They'll be at the convention seasons. They're going to travel around, and I'll get to see them every time we go to a show. But I have to get my own and paint my own now.
Like your kids going off to college.
Yeah, come back.
One thing I will say about having built the kits is that it takes some good discipline to use magnets and put them in there, and it takes some patience. You know, in that. It's easy to put magnets in backwards. It's yeah. easy to even like when you think you have a system to put magnets in backwards. So what's your system? What do you do when you magnetize?
You bring up a really good point. Polarity is definitely one of those things that like even seasoned hobbyists sometimes get wrong. So in my insider, I actually address this with a couple of quick tips. But the big one is that everybody, I think, has like an old paintbrush laying around that you don't really use, but for some reason we've just never let it go. and I don't know why that is, but I have like five or six paintbrushes, and so what I ended up doing was cutting the metal part off with the brush, what's known as the ferrule. I just cut it off with the ferrule, and I drilled down using just one of the pin vices, and I drilled down the magnet size that I have around. So if you have, you know, and a couple extra 3/16 magnets, or if you have a 1/8, you can get these in most hobby stores or online. They're super cheap. And then I just drill down about two magnets in space and glue them in so that I have kind of a polarity tool. I know that whenever I put a magnet in on the tip of this and set it into the magnet slot, that it's always going to face the same direction. So I choose either the arms or the core. And for mine, I choose the arms because you're going to be magnetizing way more arms than you are body parts. So I attach all my magnets in a giant stick to the end of my polarity thing, and I glue them into all my arms. So I know that all of my magnets are facing in the same direction. And then I take a couple extra magnets, attach them to my arms, since I know that that polarity has already been set. And then I glue the magnets basically into the body so that I never have to worry about it. The other thing is, like, not everybody has like a couple extra magnets or a tool and they want to build their stuff, right? So what I'll tell people to do is, take your magnets, put them in a giant stick, and glue, mark one side of the magnet stick, the very bottom, so that you have one polarity marked. And then the opposite one, glue those magnets into the body. So you have three magnets in your core facing the same polarity direction, so you don't have to worry about it. Then when you go to put your arms on, stick your magnets into the body, and then take like a Sharpie and just mark the backside of the magnet so you know that that's the polarity side you need to glue into your arm. So you never get your polarity backwards.
That's basically what I do. I just, before getting going, I take a Sharpie and I mark the magnet, flip it to the bottom, mark the magnet, flip it to the bottom, mark the magnet until the color comes back to the top. That way I know that I've marked the polarity on all of them. And then I set them into the chest and the arm sockets, all being the same polarity. And then you got to wait for that to dry, because I have at least once made the mistake of going and checking an arm's polarity against something while dry fitting, and the socket not being dry yet, and then it sucks the magnet out with the glue, and then you glue two magnets together. Oh yep. Boy, that's not fun.
No, it's definitely not. And yeah, that's the big thing, right? Because like, these magnets aren't very weak. Our magnets are, they have a good pull to them, so they will definitely, if the glue isn't set, pull that magnet right out of the socket. Because I mean, that we wanted these to be firm connection points when you attach your arms to your war jacks. So we made sure that the magnets had a good pull to them. That's for sure.
Absolutely. I also, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just, that was it.
I was also going to say, I recommend to also have a tool to tap them into place. An old paintbrush is great, or like a toothpick or something, just because you'll find yourself, you'll get the magnet in there with the glue, and then maybe the polarity from the other side of the arm wants to flip the magnet over, or that magnet's just being a jerk and was like, ha ha, now I'm standing sideways. And a little something to just tap it into place goes a long way.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't find, in my experience, I didn't find them too bad. I usually just used my thumb and held the magnet in place or pushed it down. But I mean, yeah, the opposite side of a paintbrush works pretty well. Anything that's not metal works great. If you're using anything that's metal, you have a chance that you might suck the magnet back out or it might dislodge it further.
Yeah, absolutely. So, of the factions we've seen, which are you most excited to play?
This is actually a pretty tough one. Everything gets me really excited, but I think honestly, at this point, I might just be 100% in on everything at this point for
Yeah.
like my ideal plan right now, looking at the projected release schedule that we put out there, I think I'm gonna go to Gen Con. I'm gonna get the two battle group boxes and start there because you get your two battle groups, which is Warjack A, Warjack B, and Warcaster C. Then in November, or as close as we can get to them, grab the Orgoth and Signar army boxes, which is going to get me my Warcaster A's, an additional Warjack A and B, and then my troop and solo support so that I can get my armies onto the table and going. And then this kind of takes me through November, but once I've got those two up in November, we've got the Kador Winter course coming out. So I'll grab the starter army box there, and Warcaster C is going to be released for them, so I'll pick them up. So that puts me at the same point for all four, and then so this takes us to November, and then once I've got the army set up like that, then the mercenaries are coming out near the end of December, which I mean that's the end of 2022. We're turning the corner. Dusk is coming out in 2023, and
Dusk.
we've already teased it. Warlocks and War Beasts are joining the fray officially in August of 2023 at most likely Gen Con. So, like, I got to get my core four painted up. Like, I want to treat this kind of like, a magic deck. I want to have all of it so that I can play it when I want to, how I want to, and whatever I want to when, the formats start coming up and going online.
Heck yeah, that's awesome. Well, any parting shots? Anything else you want to say before we close this out here?
Yes, not sure when 100% this is dropping, but Gen Con's going to be sweet. Come and find me. I'm over at our events area helping Travis Marg run all the events at Gen Con. Also, I'll be over at booth 429 where we're going to be at. That's super excited to see everybody. I cannot wait for everybody to get their hands on these models finally and see how they're going to end up painting them. I think all the players are really going to enjoy.
Awesome. Heck yeah. I am super excited. I'll be there giving demos for Mon Pox Megaton Mashup 2 and also playing lots of demos of Mark IV. So come hang out. Let's talk. Let's jam.
Yeah, let's do it.
You want to say roll drums?
Roll drums.
Roll drums. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. In this segment, we are going to have a good old-fashioned gamer hangout. For this segment, we're brought on two of the War Machine playtesters who have been hard at work grinding games of Mark IV so that we can find any bugs or issues that were along the way. With me is Dan Yount and Marc-André LeBlanc. How's it going, guys?
Hey, I'm doing all right. This is Dan.
Hey there, it's Marc Andre here.
Excellent. Thank you both for coming along. I brought you on today to talk about Mark IV and to get into the gritty details of the game. I tasked each of you with preparing a list for one of the new armies, and we want to talk about the list building process and what goes into your head with your list building selection. Dan has taken Orgoth Sea Raiders and Mark has taken Signar Storm Division. So let's start off by talking a little bit about the armies, how they play, and what drew you to them. Mark, why don't you start us off?
For sure. Storm Legion is all about electroleaps. It's all about lightning guns. It's about Warjacks with pretty decent mat and rat stats. I've been playing Signar pretty much since I started playing War Machine back in Mark 1, so it was an easy pick for me. I like blue.
Awesome. So taking that bridge, was it the fact that these were Storm, or was it just I'm a Swan all the way?
Yeah, I mean, really, it could be any flavor of Signar, and I would be in. It's easy for me.
Awesome. So I've been a Swan player for years. I do really like everything Storm in it. This is, you know, right up my alley too. And it all looks really good. So Dan, tell us about Orgoth.
Yeah, so the Orgoth Sea Raiders, I would say, attracted me to them. They remind me a little bit of Circle Orbros and Legion's Primal Terror's Theme Force, if you had a baby between them. And they're both two armies I play, so that explains why I like playing Orgoth. What they're going to be all about is hitting you hard and fast and kind of challenging your positioning because they have a quite large amount of harpoon-type weapons in faction. But at the same time, they're pretty resilient. They're going to be able to brick up and take a lot of hits when they need to be able to.
I love all of the harpoons. Harpoons for days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a lot of fun kind of seeing just how far you can drag models across the table with Orgoth.
There's definitely some forward thinking in the layers of pulling things out and in which order you do it so that you can achieve a goal of, you know, getting to a warcaster or getting deep on something that something wasn't expected to get taken out early. So I do really see the cross comparison between that and some of the Legion and Circle themes.
Absolutely.
Orgoth have always been such a legend in the wild. To see them on the table now is just awesome. They're definitely my playstyle. I expect I'll probably be playing a lot of Sea Raiders. I like the attrition value that they bring. So let's talk about the models. Mark, can you tell me about the Battle Box caster for Storm Legion?
Yeah, so Anson Wolf, you know, brings, I think, some pieces that Signar players will be familiar with. Energizer and Positive Charge are two spells a lot of Signar players are used to casting. He's got some similarities with sort of Jake's Two, but he definitely gets a lot more accomplished in melee. Hopefully people have seen the new card for him, but he can get the job done personally, and he also, you know, cranks the damage up with his jacks in like a real way.
Awesome. I really like his spell list. It does definitely scream Signar. It's all the old staples. Energizer is one of my favorite spells. And racks are really cool. I really like this system and the ability to customize your spell list. It's a whole new way to interact with warcasters. What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, definitely. They make each game a little bit different, as you can change what your army's capable of doing depending on what spells you're bringing. They also bring this kind of cool tactical layer to the game, as it gives you a little bit of a small window into your opponent's thought process and intentions when both of you reveal what cards you picked at the start of the game. So, for example, if they chose some rack spells that create clouds, then I'm going to be checking out both table sides and thinking about how they might be using them. If they're going to take some spells that make their troopers faster or give something like reposition, then maybe my opponent's going to be trying to be positioning aggressively for scenario. And so rack spells just get my wheels turning before deployment even starts each game.
Mark, how do you feel about racks?
Yeah, I think racks are cool. They kind of add a second step to the whole, you know, like, oh, I'm not sure what my opponent's going to drop. So, you know, so what should I drop in response? So it's like another layer of both, like, you know, they'll give you an out to a lot of maybe areas where like, oh, my army's sort of lacking in this department. So it's good for newer players, but it also adds like another layer of sort of like chicken between you and your opponent, which I think, you know, appeals to the more experienced players like myself as well. I love the Signar rack. It's got snipe.
Heck yeah. Snipe is excellent and everybody should have access to it. And I think that's what I like most about the spell rack system, is that there are tons of warcasters that I love the aesthetic or I love the style too. And then I'm like, man, this guy just does not hit my flavor of how I like to play the game. I would just much rather play this other Warcaster because they have the flavor that I'm looking for. But that can stagnate really fast when you're like, well, I like attrition, so Anson Durst forever. You can only play so many of those games. So being able to take these Warcasters and customize them and play them the way I want to play to express the game how I want to express it is, you know, absolutely appealing to me. Instantly pulled me in. It was one of the first features I latched onto where I was like, yes, I can get behind this because I want to be able to play any Warcaster the way I want to play them. Compare and contrast here. Dan, what is Orgoth Sea Raider's Battle Box Warcaster like?
So Horusk is a big-time army support type caster. Now, with his feat and spell list, what he's going to be doing a lot is sitting towards the back of his army. So maybe he casts Windstorm, protect them from some shooting. And then he's going to be wanting to be spending his stack of focus to give everyone some rerolls with Fate Blessed. Then transitioning towards the middle endgame, Horusk is going to want to start to rotate towards the front lines since he has Mad 8, Pal 17. He can really kind of kill a lot of stuff just on his own. And he also has Blood Boon to combo with. So there's nothing quite like charging forward, killing something, Blood Booning, Thunderstrike to slam something away, and then vanishing forward even further to go and deal a bit more punishment.
Absolutely gnarly. And everybody loves rerolls, right? So rerolls on a Warcaster is one of the first things that I'm going to reach for anytime I want to play. And I am just so happy with his kit. Like, chef's kiss. So the model is stunning, too. I could talk a little bit about that. But instead, let's talk about battle groups. Mark, tell me about the Heavy Warjack and Storm Legion. What's its loadout like? And what's your favorite weapon Cortex pick?
Right. Well, now that you can sort of change the loadout as you want, there's a lot of options. But for me, the first thing has to be the very humble Relentless Charge Cortex. it's the cheapest one, costs 1 point. So it gives you, you know, lets you kind of build from there. But it's just really nice to have in Signar where if you want Pathfinder base on your Warjack when it's charging, you've got it. So super happy with that one. And as far as the weapons, it's got to be the Electro Bombard. You're not going to be pairing it with the Relentless Cortex, but it's just this huge, powerful, you know, long-range lightning gun that you can boost in a few ways. And it's just great at shredding enemy infantry.
That's interesting that your favorite weapon and your favorite Cortex are at odds with each other. So let's take that a step further. What would be your preferred weapon with the Relentless Charge Cortex? And what would be your favorite Cortex with the Bombardment?
Sure. If with the Relentless Charge Cortex, I like to keep it cheap. So, you know, like Hammer and Shield, it's just a great way to go. Tanky little sort of heavy that does business in melee and is not super easy to take out. With the gun, it's got to be the Advanced Optics Cortex. You know, being able to snipe it, aim, and then ignore stealth out to 17 inches with that bombard is just fantastic.
So good.
Yeah, solves a lot of problems.
Not a lot of problems to not be solved by boostable long-range guns. I can't get over some of the weapon options, too. They are really good. Everything in that pack is worth a shake in playing. And the customization is really fun, too. Just to be able to say, I want the one with the hammer and the shield, because I like that combo, is very satisfying. So, Dan, tell me about the Orgoth Heavy.
Yeah, so I'd say the Tyrant, with his loadout, he has pretty distinct places that you'll find him. I've kind of narrowed it down to three. The first is going to be in the back, just bringing on some support fire. He has both the Belcher and the Shredder, which are both great guns. You'll usually use that with the Hunter Head. And then after that, you have kind of a mid-range type field, which is when you're bringing out the Harpoon, which can be extra terrifying when you consider that with dual attack, you can charge and then kill something and then shoot the Harpoon, or you can straight up just trample and shoot the Harpoon as well. And a lot of people might have kind of bad experiences with navigating around harpoons in Mark III, just because there's so many models, it's kind of easy to body block. But since the model count is quite a bit smaller in Mark IV, pretty much just means that drag type effects are that much harder to actually prevent with you know, just throwing one or two models in front of them. And then finally, the third place you'll find the Tyrant on the battlefield is just straight up right up in your grill with its flail, causing all sorts of mayhem, using the threshers, you know, basically kicking butt, taking names. And all of its left-hand weapons are great for complementing all the different play styles, because they have both a lot of variance in their point values, from maybe cheap stuff, just a claw, or an expensive shield. And then if you do have a little bit of points to spare, the Tyrant does have two kind of pricey heads, but they do give kind of a character warjack type of feel, where you take the overtake head or the arcane vortex head. It ends up turning into a warjack that your opponent kind of has to constantly be thinking about as it's going around the battlefield.
I love the arcane vortex head. That's like one of my favorites. And I think you raised up a good point about the harpoons too, especially with how units work now with unit movement and placement and all the different things that they can do. The harpoons play into that even more. You can create little funnels and holes for you to burrow your army right through.
Absolutely.
So next up, I think we should talk about light warjacks. They were really potent in playtest. Mark, why don't you tell us about your experience with the Signar Lights?
Yeah, the Courser is, I think, a pretty good conversion of, or distillation, you know, of all the Signar archetypes for light jacks. You can kind of give it an arc node if you want. You can give it guns. You can have it kind of be a little bit scrappy in melee. I love the shield guard head. It's just a great, you know, utility ability to have around the table, especially when you've got all these drags flying around. So it's really nice to have. I like the sort of like quasi hunter build where you're giving it the mag bolter, which is that pal 6 armor piercing we all know and love.
It's so potent.
Yeah, that's still range 14. You know, if you like hunters, you're gonna like this guy. And then usually just giving it the spike, just keeping it relatively inexpensive. But if you want, you can easily, you know, give it the shield, make it a little bit tankier, and still give it, you know, like the broadsword in melee so that it's actually doing damage. So sort of, again, sort of like you can kind of build it how you want. But so far, it's been a lot of fun to play. And I just got to see the model, you know, a couple days ago, and it's looking great.
I love how both through the heavy and the light, we've had a congruent theme that you can build them how you want, and there's so many cool builds.
Mm-hmm.
So let's flip the table here and talk about the Orgoth Light. Dan, take it away.
Yeah, so I think kind of the big thing that the Jackal benefits from is being pretty inexpensive, so it's able to be really easily slot anywhere into your army. There are kind of two basic forms that I would typically play with the Jackal. And the first is going to be also kind of similar to a Signar Hunter type Warjack. I mean, with the Jackal, you can get a range 14, pal 14, crit brutal Warjack for as cheap as 7 points. And that thing with rerolls or boosts can just absolutely take huge chunks out of, you know, even heavily armored targets. And you can also really deck it out with a shield and more guns if you want. It can be a like 11 points or something like that. So it's really hard to beat that sort of value for a shooting warjack. The second mode I play is kind of like a super solo. So, I mean, if I told you that you could get a combat solo with boostable attacks, 26 boxes, and def 12, arm 17, you'd probably be kind of interested, right? And so that's kind of what the melee jackal is all about. You can get 5 points for a dude that just kind of runs around and boosts attacks and is annoying. Or you can get it all the way up to like 8 points for a jack with a spear and shield that's tying up all your opponent's stuff and it's kind of just annoying to remove. And the reason why that's kind of more relevant now is with the new free strike rules that cause your models to lose their combat actions, it's kind of a lot more relevant when you have models that can just engage your opponent's stuff and just chill. That's somewhat valuable, actually.
So one thing I'd like to talk about before we wrap up here is the list creation process. And I asked each of you to bring a list today and talk about it, mostly because I wanted you to go through the process and think about it and have that fresh in your mind. So, Mark, what was your list creation process like for Storm Legion?
Yeah, so the Anson kind of has an interesting tension where his feet both wants a decent amount of infantry and of jacks to take advantage of his feet, because basically when your opponent kills your stuff, your battle group gets to activate and make attacks. I lean a bit towards having jacks that have a combination of melee and shooting because I want that flexibility with the feet. And I'm looking to take cheap infantry to get as many triggers of that feat as possible. So, you know, the Stormblade Legionnaires, for example, are a good pick. And again, giving that flexibility where maybe you're taking an Electro Bombard on the Striker with a cheap melee weapon complement, kind of works for me. As far as the command cards, this list I'd say was pretty strapped for points. So I just kind of went free all the way. Big fan of squeezing every point I can out of the list. So a couple that come to mind for sure is Breakthrough, because I want to be able to move a heavy out of melee and shoot with it, mm-hmm. you know, at sort of whenever I want to. As well, I like Power Swell to sometimes use Anson to just go in and beat face on his own. That extra focus is an extra pretty powerful attack, especially with Blood Quenched. So that one focus can matter a lot to him, especially in the late game.
Awesome. And I do appreciate your insight there into command cards. Dan, what is your process like when building your Orgoth Sea Raiders list?
Yeah, so Orgoth is an army that I think benefits from taking a little bit of everything. They have a lot of great threat vectors that they can come at you with. And so, you know, why not just take advantage of all of them? So with Horus specifically, what you'll often see is maybe a couple units of Ulkor Axers as kind of its primary central force, as they are kind of beefy and can benefit a lot from Horus's feet. And then coupled with maybe some ambushers for harassment, different warjacks or models with harpoons to kind of create those extra vectors. The command cards that I usually run with him are going to fill the role of some support models. Careful reconnaissance for Pathfinder is really common to take. And then even some additional layered defenses for his army. So I like going and taking Taunt and maybe hiding a model behind a big line of axers so no one can see him. And then he's going to be giving them those extra defenses. With Harass, I like to bring True Inspiration, which hands out tough to a unit for a round so that they can get some additional benefits from his feat as well.
Right on. So is there anything else either of you would like to say about these armies or these models or the list building consideration before we wrap it up here?
No, I think that pretty much covers everything for now.
How about yourself, Mark?
It's been a blast so far, and I look forward to seeing more of these spoilers.
Absolutely. Well, the best place to do that is to keep your eyes peeled on all of Privateer Press social media channels. Check us out on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. I'm trying to get a TikTok going. We are going to be proliferating this information everywhere. Don't forget to come and see us at Gen Con. You've heard us repeat it in every section. You know what booth we're going to be at, but we'll be there. Hope to see you there. All right, gentlemen. So one thing I'd like to do is I'd like to have you both try to say
roll drums.
Nailed it.